It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The National Weather Service says there were 9 tornadoes in Wisconsin Friday night and Saturday morning. Coming up, we'll find out which parts of the state got hit the hardest and get an update on cleanup efforts and power outages. First, when President Trump tweeted that 4 congresswomen who have spoken out against him should leave the U.S. and go back to the countries they came from, members of the alt-right, white supremacists, and other extremists celebrated. The Anti-Defamation League rounded up some of their responses, including favorable tweets from neo-Nazi and website publisher Andrew Anglin, alt-right leader Richard Spencer, white supremacist organizer Augustus Invictus, and Matt Parrott, who used to lead the white supremacist Traditionalist Worker Party. Our next guest has been looking into the ways alt-right ideology has been moving through American culture and politics before and now during the Trump administration. Alexandra Minna Stern leads the Sterilization and Social Justice Lab at the University of Michigan, where she's a professor of American culture, history, and women's studies. She's the author of the new book, Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to dig first into a couple of terms that'll be coming up a lot today, I think. Alt-right and alt-light. Before we get into your book, could you explain how we define roughly these two groups?
Well, alt-right is that large umbrella term for a range of different movements on what they like to call increasingly the dissident right. Many on the alt-right have abandoned that term because it kind of lost some of its cachet after Charlottesville and other incidents. But the alt-right broadly encompasses white nationalists, white supremacists, neo-Nazi, and also misogynistic and anti-feminist movements all under one kind of unwieldy umbrella. And the alt-light tends to be those provocateurs, often on social media, who are not necessarily or not explicitly on the white nationalist bandwagon, but express many of the same sentiments around animus towards feminism, towards liberalism, towards globalism, often code word for, you know, Jewish influence. And they have both a fractious and a synergistic relationship between the two. So the alt-light are often more prominent. They'll dabble in conspiracy theories. They'll have more followers on Twitter. But there are those that shuffle back and forth, and particularly the ideas and memes are popular, like in what we might call the alt-verse, move between these two blurred sides.
And that's the focus of your book, not so much the individuals or the timeline here, but the ideas, the themes, and memes. Why was it important to you to dig into that element of the alt-right or whatever it calls itself now?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. Journalists and other authors have written some really excellent works to help us understand the resurgence of white nationalism. Often those look at key organizations or particular individuals to understand the trajectories of these individuals, why they were compelled by certain ideas to do personality profiles. And, you know, there's good journalistic storytelling that revolve around people and their particular stories and inclinations. But what I really wanted to do with this book was to understand the ideas behind the alt-right, and particularly the extent to which are these old, you know, kind of, is this new wine in old bottles, you know, these types of questions. And also to understand, you know, how has political and cultural discourse changed in American society really in a fairly short amount of time? It might have been a long time in coming, but over the past 3 or 4 years, we have seen a shift where both certain terms are recognizable, and as you mentioned at the opening of, you know, our discussion, you know, the president is tweeting basically an anti-diversity, you know, an anti-feminist tweet, which resonates with, you know, the alt-right. So I'm very interested in thinking about where we are as a society in terms of what kind of discourse we're using and the harms that can come with that discourse.
You mentioned old wine in a new bottle, and you also study this kind of rhetoric, these kind of ideas from a century and longer ago in American history, the idea of the United States being a race or ethnicity-based country, not an ideas or civics-based country. Can you talk about that thread and how it's reemerged?
Definitely. I mean, in a way, that was how I began working on this project. In 2015, 2016, I was aware of the emergence, you know, kind of on the sidelines of what became what came to be called the alt-right. And what I began to realize was that many of the eugenics texts and the eugenic ideas that, for example, certain racial or minority groups are overbreeding, are over-fecund, they are diluting, you know, the white race. These ideas were resurfacing and being taken up with great gusto by alt-righters and white nationalists. And in fact, some of the key authors from, you know, 100 years ago, like Madison Grant and Lothrop Stoddard and some of the other really key figures that were part of eugenic racism are being celebrated actively by white nationalists. They celebrate their birthdays. They like to dip back into their ideas and repurpose them. So I wanted to understand what was at play with that and to put it in the context of the contemporary moment. And I'll just add that I'm trained as a historian, so my previous work has really used archival materials, you know, basically old pieces of paper that you find in boxes and, you know, storage units that a lot of people don't look at. And this project was different because my archive, so to speak, a lot of it was, it's all born digital material, including, you know, social media sites as well as publications and kind of what we might call the intellectual canon, you know, of the alt-right literati. So I delved into that to really write what I, you know, hope is a kind of critical history of the present and this particular moment, just to better understand it and to put it in context.
Talking to Alexandra Minna Stern about her book, Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Well, if these ideas of a race-based nation are the old wine, the internet, I guess, is the new bottle. How has the online world, the social media world, changed the way these ideas are spread?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's played a critical role. On the other hand, we don't want to overstate the role that it's played. So on the one hand, social media provided, you know, a network and a set of interlocking platforms for memes to be developed, for ideas to ricochet around in a way that was kind of particular to the alt-right, especially in its kind of more effective phase around, let's say, the 2016 Trump election, where Pepe the Frog was bouncing around the internet and was being, you know, ironically used by those on the dissident right or the alt-right, whichever term we want to use. And so social media really helped people find each other. It also provided cover insofar as, you know, social media is a place where people can have anonymous identity. They can use aliases and avatars. And so there was a real sense, though, that you know, there was a frenzy of meme culture, let's say, that was worked to the advantage of the alt-right. Since Charlottesville and, you know, awareness of, you know, a group like the Proud Boys and kind of the riots they've been involved in, there's been deplatforming and demonetization of some of these internet celebrities. So we know, for example, Alex Jones, Gavin McGinnis, who I just mentioned, and others, they've been completely deplatformed, partially deplatformed, taken down for 24 hours or maybe a week. But one of the things that's, you know, kind of interesting and I think important to keep an eye on is that, you know, all of this has happened too little too late. You know, the internet was an ideal space for many of these groups to spread content and to proliferate content, and algorithms often worked in their favor until Facebook and other social media companies started looking at them. So that's one thing, is definitely the social media has played an integral role. It's been crucial to what, you know, is called red pilling, you know, kind of, and just amplifying their message. On the other hand, you know, it's not all social media. You know, there are real life networks of groups and organizations in the United States, but also in Europe and other parts of the world. And I think it's important, you know, when thinking about this kind of, you know, old, you know, new wine, old bottles, or whatever metaphor we want to use, that, you know, the alt-right is part of a transnational phenomenon where we're seeing the similar rise of authoritarianism and national populism in countries as different as Brazil, Hungary, Sweden, Italy, other parts of the world. And the alt-right really sees itself as connected to this international wave of the rise of nationalism. And so I think it's really important to keep track of that as well.
We're talking to Alexandra Minna Stern, professor at the University of Michigan. Her new book is Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about her research? Do you see these ideas, these memes, maybe if you're online, from the alt-right popping up in your social media feeds? Do you respond? How so? How do others respond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Alexandra Minna Stern about her new book, Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the rise of the alt-right? Do you think it's been blown to some extent out of proportion? What have you seen in your social media feeds, if anything, and what questions do you have for our guest about her research? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alexandra, there is, as you mentioned, some tension, some range within the views of these groups. A very common theme, though, seems to be a fear that there is something significant called the white race. The definition has changed over time, and that it's under threat because of diversity. Can you talk about that as one of the central ideas?
That definitely is one of the core ideas, is that, first of all, there's something called the white race actually exists, that it is under threat from changing demographics in American society. So one of these things that these disparate groups that we might put under the broad umbrella of the alt-right share is really a sense of demographic crisis that, you know, the connected to projections about the changing composition of the American population, to one that we know around mid-century, given census projections, you know, we will become an ethno-racial plurality in the United States. White nationalists are often clanging the bell, thinking about that midpoint of the century and trying to, you know, as they would put it, raise consciousness among whites to protect themselves and to be ready for becoming what they think they will become, which is a persecuted minority. So that definitely, and it's kind of, if anyone is familiar with the kind of discourse around white minority status in South Africa, it's very similar to that. There are resonances in terms of the language and the kind of the fear, the ideas of fear around that.
And also gender is a very common theme, and relations between men and women, and a revulsion and a stated revulsion towards transgender people as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the kind of key, one of the main focuses in my book, is that I really want to show that white nationalism is not just about race. It's just as much about gender and sexuality. Core to white nationalism is, you know, it's this aggrieved white male entitlement that contains a heavy dose of misogyny, of anti-feminism, to some extent homophobia, although that varies from quarter to quarter, but most certainly transphobia. And I think it's a very interesting question to ask, why is the alt-right and also the alt-light, for that matter, if we take those, you know, use those terms, why are they both so transphobic? I think part of it has to do with this fear of loss of order. I mean, if there's anything that provides order, it's a strict gender binary, and it's a strict cisgender binary where, you know, men are men and have male genitalia and women are women and they have female genitalia. That's why among some white nationalists, they're less concerned with gay people, because it's about sexual preference, not about gender identity. And so there's something deeply destabilizing about gender identity and about trans identity, about gender fluidity. And so that is really something that is quite, you know, a violent sentiment that's at the core of contemporary white nationalism.
You mentioned that idea. It's traditionalism in a lot of ways. Can you talk about the nostalgia for a past that may not have existed as envisioned?
Definitely. I mean, I think that that discussion of gender and thinking about traditional gender roles and traditionalism in, you know, more broadly, where, you know, there are fantasies. I mean, you can read white nationalism as a great fantasy of both returning to this nostalgic past that never was, usually, you know, pinpointed about 1960s America, when America was about 90% white. You know, when Leave It to Beaver was on TV, when there were, you know, families moving to the suburbs, there was obviously, you know, the height of racial segregation. I mean, that's kind of like the ideal time period or microcosm of what America looked like. So certainly there's that gender traditionalism and really this idea of kind of order. At the same time, there's looking towards a future, you know, in which technology is used to enhance and to kind of support white identity politics. And I'll just mention that, you know, one of the aims of my book was to really engage, you know, some of the book link texts that have influenced the alt-right. And many of those were written by, and they've been since translated by, those on the European New Right who started writing in the 70s and 80s and really over the past decades. And many of them take up these ideas of how to support, you know, what they would call identitarianism by both looking towards the past, towards a primordial, simpler, more traditional past, but also, you know, embracing a future in which technology is mobilized and harnessed to support, you know, white or European majorities. And so that would be, there's kind of a double-sided aspect to these fantasies of, they're nostalgic, but they're also forward-looking.
Talking to Alexandra Minna Stern about her new book, Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Oh, we asked on Facebook to people to share their thoughts. Gail writes, that she doesn't think the alt-right is spreading. She says, I think social media and news media just report on it more. So does it seem more present just because we're paying more attention, Alexandra?
Well, I do think that there is a, you know, risk of amplifying it. And my point is not to overstate its influence or, you know, say the alt-right is taking over American society. But again, to be aware of the ways in which the alt-right and, you know, other right-wing movements have shifted the field of discourse and the way in which we even talk about things and conceptualize things in American society. At the same time, I think we need to be cognizant that we're living through a moment in which, you know, there are a good number of white Americans who they certainly might not be ready to join white nationalist organizations, but, you know, feel some sympathy or some allegiance to some of the key ideas. And some of those key ideas or concerns would be that white heritage is being corroded and needs to be protected, that diversity is something that doesn't help white people. In fact, it harms them. And so if you look at polling and survey research, you know, it generally shows that about 30% of white Americans agree with those types of statements. And if you couple that with concerns about demographic change, especially leading up to the mid-century, it's just something to keep an eye on and to keep track of because, you know, it is possible that, you know, these ideas could gain more adherence. So my goal is not to amplify their ideas, but really to deconstruct them, to put them in perspective, and to track them and to be aware when they are encroaching you know, on our society and on the way we do things.
What is at stake if these ideas spread and don't get countered along the way?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of it has to do with the media environment and the political environment. And so, you know, it's interesting, again, to think about President Trump's tweets as, you know, he's kind of abandoned dog whistles. He made a very racist statement, which I would say resonates with some of the kind of key beliefs of white nationalism around concerns of diversity and the idea that who belongs in America and who doesn't belong in America, you know, and those types of questions. I think what we risk is, you know, more political polarization, more political strife, racial animosity. And, you know, we know that some people are incited by, you know, this type of language and, you know, these types of statements to actually enact violence. So there is, you know, a real element of potential harm there.
I want to talk for a few moments about members of the alt-right trying to distance themselves from being viewed as full-on neo-Nazis, either by distinguishing their views or behaviors or by taking an ironic stance, saying, we said that, that was just a joke. Can you take a couple minutes as we wrap up to tackle that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you've identified two of the key trends. One is, you know, this has been going on for, you know, several generations of white nationalists, this, you know, sense that they wanted to distance themselves from swastikas or, you know, Ku Klux, you know, the hoods of the Ku Klux Klan and so on, to become more normalized, to become more sanitized, to become more appealing to mainstream America. That certainly is the case among many white nationalists today, not all, but, you know, some of the more prominent and one could say the more effective in terms of gaining adherence and having some visibility, as they've normalized their image and have embraced a kind of fashy, almost European-style image. That's one thing. On the other hand, and this is why it's so slippery and it's so hard to report on this from a scholarly or journalistic perspective, is there's always this aspect of irony and plausible deniability that's connected to the kind of the meme culture of the alt-right, where someone can, you know, post something and then back off and say, well, that was really a joke, or, you know, I meant it in this way. So there's like multiple flips, you know, around, you know, using things, using memes and other images sardonically. And I think that rather than actually trying to, it's a losing battle to try to fully understand it or nail that down in an objective way. It's better to think of it as this is the kind of media ecosystem in which we're living, and that will help us get a handle on how things like Pizzagate can happen and how that can then feed back into at least some, you know, some aspects of the alt-right. So it's, you know, it's kind of learning more about actually what like trolling culture is and what, you know, what social media culture is, at the same time that, you know, we keep tabs on how the alt-right seeks to normalize itself.
We'll leave it there. Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Alexandra Minna Stern, University of Michigan professor, author of the new book Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Coming up, we'll look at the damage from this weekend's rough weather. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, recent flooding across the Midwest has caused billions of dollars in damage, and it's also meant major setbacks for important economic sectors, including farming. Levees are used in many communities to control flooding, but our guest says they may be making things worse in some cases. First, flash flooding was just part of the problem weather-wise for Wisconsin over the last few days. Severe storms moved through the state Friday night and Saturday morning, knocking out power to more than 150,000 customers. More than 20,000 are still without power as of this afternoon. The National Weather Service confirmed there were 9 tornadoes in the state in less than 24 hours. The torrential rain, hail, and wind caused extensive property damage, shut down roads, and may have contributed to at least 2 deaths. Governor Evers has declared a state of emergency for the state. Wisconsin Emergency Management, which is part of the State Department of Military Affairs, is leading cleanup efforts. Captain Joe Trovato is a spokesperson for the Department of Military Affairs. Captain Trovato, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you give us an update on the power situation? Where are the biggest outages? Who's still affected?
Right. So really the northeast and east central part of the state are still facing significant power outages. There are, as you alluded to, still thousands of people without power right now. But we are hopeful that that as the day goes on, that those numbers continue to drop and you know, but it still might be a day or two before we're looking at full restoration across the state.
And what kind of help is out there in communities where people are still without power? Is there some kind of assistance for them?
Right. So the local communities, first responders and law enforcement and the emergency managers in each individual city and county are doing a fantastic job of just trying to provide those basic basic resources and needs for people. At the state level, we're being responsive to requests for assistance that come in from individual incident commands or, in our cases, county emergency managers. So right now, we have a couple of requests for assistance from Langlade County, where they have requested the help of the National Guard to help distribute water to, for example, to help people flush their septic systems. So these are some things you take for granted when you have power, but when it is out for an extended period of time, some of those things become much more critical.
Now take us back to Friday night and Saturday morning. I've heard some firsthand accounts, but talk about some of the biggest parts of these storms that came through.
Right. Well, there were some serious straight line winds, a lot of heavy rain, and really these straight line winds and tornadoes just wreaked havoc on power lines, a lot of downed trees. It created a lot of debris that is also scattered in many cases in rural areas, but in some cases across roadways and certainly the flash flooding didn't help matters either. So there was a lot of damage and a lot of impact over a short amount of time over the weekend here.
Yeah, where did we see flooding around the state?
Well, it's in a number of different areas. The central northern part of the state really has bore the brunt of it. I don't exactly have all of the exact locations directly in front of me at this exact time, but we are posting that information on readywisconsin.gov, where we are posting the incident reports that'll be going up here in a little while on our website and have the latest information.
Talking to Captain Joe Travato with the Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs, looking at this weekend's storms in Wisconsin, the damage they did, and recovery efforts. You mentioned that WisconsinReady.gov website. Can you talk about the kind of resources people can find there before, during, and after emergencies?
Absolutely. That's so we've created a page on there specifically for this incident, and that's where we again post the incident reports, so people have a really good idea of the latest from individual counties and municipalities in many cases. But we also post information on there that is good to know information. So, for example, there's an article or a couple of documents on there about food spoilage, because we're starting to get into that phase here. If you've been without power now for a while, you might be asking yourself the question of what's okay to keep and what do I need to discard at this point. So there's some good information on there about that. There's information about how to safely use generators and how, you know, tips on where to put those generators and keep them safely away from your house and operate it efficiently. And there's even information out there about CO2. And other hazards and drinking water and whatnot as well. So there's a lot of good information out there, and hopefully people can get on there and take advantage of some of that knowledge that we're trying to share.
As we mentioned, the governor declared a state of emergency. In practical terms, what does that do?
Well, the state of emergency opens up resources from the state level. In this case, it authorizes Major General Dunbar, the Adjutant General of Wisconsin, to commit National Guard troops if needed, and it also directs other state agencies to offer their support and resources as well. So in this case, the National Guard has been mobilized. There are approximately two dozen National Guard troops that are involved with distributing water in Langlade County.
Do you have advice for people preparing for the next time severe weather is coming through the state?
Well, you know, the best time to prepare, of course, is before a major incident occurs, and you know, there's always we're always trying to post readiness tips on our website and trying to make sure that people are prepared. They're thinking about things like stockpile of food or fresh water or generators, but we also want to encourage people to when the storm does hit after the storm, that they're making sure that they're reaching out via our 211 program, where they're calling 211 to report damages from the storm and keep an accurate record and detail exactly what happened. So the state and counties can get you the support that you need.
Is there consistent advice when we have these kind of summer weather emergencies, tornadoes, flooding, things like that, that people in emergency management are really hoping that citizens listen to and take warnings seriously?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the warnings are there for a reason. It's to make sure that you do get to a safe place and that you are heeding the warnings in the first place and finding finding the shelter that you need and preparing in advance, like I talked about. And sometimes we don't have that much warning, of course, but the steps that we take now to ensure that you have a safe place to go in your home. Have you thought through that with your family and talked about it? Do you have weather radios? Do you have spare batteries? Have you thought about a generator? Do you have flashlights stored? Do you have water? Have you given thought to how you would handle even a pet over an extended period of time without water or electricity? You know, those are things that we try to preach to think about now prior to a storm, as opposed to learning a lesson the hard way after a storm hits.
As you mentioned, power probably coming back over the next couple of days. Are there any issues with the roadways around the state, or did we dodge that this time around?
Well, there was. There's mixed reports on that. In a lot of cases, it seems that the roadways we've been able to keep the roadways largely clear. But there are some instances in some places where some debris certainly was making some roads impassable. But by and large, that situation's improving.
Captain Trovato, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Captain Joe Trovato, spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs, which oversees Wisconsin emergency management. We talked to him about the latest cleanup efforts from this weekend's storms around the state. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the problems with using levees for flood management and talk about some other strategies to deal with floods. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after days of protests, Puerto Rico's governor says he won't run for re-election, but he will remain in office. We'll talk about a scandal that ignited the protests and the political fallout as they continue. Now, when fossils of human ancestors are displayed in a museum and become the center of an exhibit, you could say the remains can take on a life of their own. Think of Lucy, the female human ancestor found in Ethiopia in the 1970s. Lydia Pine explored the controversies, exhibitions, and stories that make fossils like Lucy into celebrities. She's a historian and writer who focuses on the history of science. Her book is titled Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. Lydia, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, we think of fossils probably as, these important scientific specimens. They tell us about the history of the world. You kind of go beyond that into how some fossils become almost pop culture celebrities. Why did you want to tackle that?
I love the idea of exploring why some scientific discoveries become famous and others don't. I felt that it was important to sort of peel back the layers and to say it's not just because of its scientific importance that something becomes celebrity or it becomes famous, but I wanted to see the culture and the history and the media and the everything else that sort of surrounds a celebrity scientific discovery, and I felt that fossils were a great way to do that.
Well, I wonder if just a good name is one of the common themes that makes it. Because, I mean, Lucy is better than, fossil AX13 or something like that. The Piltdown Man on the opposite side of reality is another catchy name. Maybe not even on purpose, but that sort of branding part of what, or The Hobbit, of course, is that part of what captures our imagination?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. That certainly if a fossil is going to become a celebrity, it has a catchy nickname. It has something that is easy to identify with, that it's a name that you can anthropomorphize or personify, and that with these kind of names, fossils can take on these personas. They can become ambassadors for science.
Now, you looked at seven particular skeletons as examples here, and you write you could have done more or fewer, but seven seemed like a good amount. What's the common thread behind this magnificent seven group of fossils?
I like that title. I almost wish now that we had been able to incorporate the magnificent seven.
It's been used, though, so, yeah.
It has. What I think the common thread, though, between these seven is first of all, the fossil is discovered at a time when certain questions are very prevalent in science, and that the fossil is able to answer certain questions that are sort of at the forefront of scientific inquiry. But it also manages to capture public imagination at the same time that it's discovered. And so it has these sort of dual threads that propel it towards celebrity, both scientific importance, but also it resonates in a cultural way, whether it's Neanderthal at the beginning of the 20th century or The Hobbit at the beginning of the 21st. There are sort of cultural reasons for people to want to be curious about them.
Is it just that they tell a story, you know, with the popularity of TED Talks and other things like that, science, but in a catchy story form? Is that what captures the public imagination?
I think that it definitely captures public imagination with the story form, but I also think that sort of having this character, this familiar sort of fossil, this sort of familiar persona is a way of identifying and making human evolution, which is very abstract, a way of feeling much more personal and much more real. And so I think that these become familiar characters that we can identify with.
Lydia Pine is a writer and historian who focuses on the history of science and material culture. Her book, Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils, looking at how some of our early human ancestors became celebrities in a way, millions of years after they died. And Lydia, you've seen some of these up close and personal, including one from South Africa. And it was the awe of the situation was a little bit dissipated, I think. Can you talk through that story?
Sure. So when I was an undergraduate, I had the opportunity to attend a paleoanthropology field school that was held in South Africa. And as part of this field school, we went to the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg to see famous fossils and to see these fossils that were very much part of South Africa's history of paleoanthropology. Professor Philip Tobias at that point was sort of South Africa's living legend of a very eminent paleoanthropologist and was responsible for giving us this fossil demo, for talking us through all of these different meaningful fossils in South Africa's history. And at the point that he was getting ready to show off the Tong child, all of us undergraduates were just so excited to see the real thing. We had all seen casts and replicas, but we hadn't seen the real thing before. And so we were just on the edges of our seats to see it. And so he pulls it out of the box and sort of starts having its little mandible clack against the teeth of it, of its upper teeth, and sort of starts to do this ventriloquy act. And all of us were just shocked. I mean, it was just, this is, you know, it was sort of like putting a mustache on the Mona Lisa or something. It was just this dissonance that we couldn't wrap our heads around of how could somebody so famous treat something like this so famous? How could that happen? And what struck me, though, in doing the research for Seven Skeletons, and what struck me as really interesting, is that just about anybody who had met Professor Tobias when he was alive and had seen him do this demo, they would tell you the same story. And that struck me that story, sort of having that ventriloquy act, was just as much a part of this fossil's life as its caliper measurements and its CT scans. But it added this cultural dimension to it.
And with something like the Tong child, I mean, you were saying you approach it almost like, you know, we might approach the Mona Lisa. It's this thing we've heard about, and there's something special about being in its presence, witnessing the real thing. They become scientific, but almost spiritual icons, it seems like.
I think so. I think that there's definitely a sense that these fossils become these cultural touchstones. And it strikes me that we use them sort of as quick shorthand or cultural reference. Anytime a new fossil is published or there's a media blip about a new fossil that's been discovered, it will almost invariably contain a reference to Lucy, for example, that a fossil will be older than Lucy. It'll be younger than Lucy. It walked bipedally, just like Lucy. And so it struck me that these fossils, these celebrity fossils, become ways for us to identify with and to really sort of create a narrative about human evolution.
Is there a lesson here for scientists and science writers to help communicate with the public, but in a good, positive way? You know, when we hear about a new fossil, human origins are really complicated, and you can really dig down into the weeds here, and I think that a lot of it can be eye-glazing. Is there a way to take what you've learned from these celebrity fossils and make scientific communication more successful?
Well, I think that Lucy actually can be a really great example of that, sort of finding something that is familiar, a fossil that's familiar, and sort of being able to use that to talk about, as you point out, human origins that are incredibly complex. Sort of having a fossil that's familiar, that this new discovery, or that this discovery that scientists are looking at in a new way, that there's a way of referring to these celebrities as guiding posts, or as sort of characters that are familiar. And I think that there's a lot of value in that. It sort of keeps you, I think, from having to reinvent the wheel or re-explain things all the time.
Well, one of those stories is, again, Lucy with maybe the mystery of her, I didn't know it was being treated as a mystery, but the mystery of her death maybe being solved. You know, there's been this analysis. It looks like she might have fallen out of the tree, which is starting arguments. Does that mean she and her species lived in trees? What are your thoughts on that?
So I think that the paper actually touches on a very long debate that's sort of been at the heart of Lucy and Lucy's species, of just how much time did Lucy spend in the trees? Just how much time did she walk around bipedally? Sort of what does all of that mean? I think that the jury is still kind of out with seeing sort of how this discovery resonates. But one of the things that really I found to be interesting was how the paper was reported, how her death was reported. And everything that I would see would say, you know, the world's most famous fossil. And it struck me that because it was Lucy, that there's this interest in the discovery and sort of in her death, that if we were looking at, you know, specimen ABC123, we probably wouldn't have that kind of coverage about. And so it felt like it very much reinforced this idea that people, both inside and outside of the scientific communities, are committed to being interested in Lucy.
Lydia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Lydia Pine. She's a writer and historian who focuses on the history of science and material culture. She talked to us about her book called Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about political unrest in Puerto Rico after a scandal, fears of corruption, and the country enters its second week of massive street protests. If you have connections with Puerto Rico, if you are from there yourself, you have friends or family there, love to hear from you about what you're hearing from Puerto Rico, from the American territory. Let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email right now at ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Wednesday morning, former special counsel Robert Mueller will testify about his investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 American elections. He'll appear in separate sessions before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. You can hear live coverage of Mueller's testimony starting at 7:30 that morning here on the Ideas Network. And then Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock, be part of a live call-in special from 1A and NPR on the details of Mueller's testimony. After Mueller has had his say, we'll make space for a nationwide conversation. So join us Wednesday evening at 7. That's coming up here on the Ideas Network. Plus, we're looking to do a little preview of that testimony tomorrow on Central Time, and you'll get more analysis on Thursday. That's all related to Robert Mueller's testimony before House committees. Question for you. What are you learning? Tomorrow at 3:15 on the show, we're going to ask you to call in and let us know what you're learning at whatever stage in life you are, whether you're picking up something new. You can get us started now. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or call and leave a message at 833-424-3327. That's 833-42-IDEAS. I got a few things I'm trying to learn. I'll tell you about that tomorrow. Judith Sears-Poisson, our executive producer, is in here. You've got a big one you've been learning lately.
I have a big one. So last fall, I did a little circus sampler class where I got to try three different circus arts at the Madison Circus Space, and I fell in love with German wheel, which when people ask me to describe it, it's kind of a huge hamster wheel. And you do gymnastics around it, on top of it, through it, by yourself, with other people, and I love it.
Yeah, let's describe this a little more fully for people not getting the picture. It's this tall, how tall is this wheel thing?
It's the one that I use is 200 centimeters. So that's about 6 feet tall.
About 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
and
there are different
are
sizes.
And,
yes,
yeah,
I use one of the smaller ones. Sometimes I have to, you know, race the kids for it.
Okay, that's where I would start too, I think.
Well,
I wouldn't hit my head still.
Yeah, so you can do cartwheels inside it. You can, there are handles, there are pedals, there are all kinds of things, and you can do really cool stuff with it. I actually tweeted out a picture of myself doing it. That's at J Sears Poisson on Twitter. Maybe we'll send it out in Central Time at WPR.org too.
Well, what are you learning? What do you want to learn? Leave us a message. 833-424-3327. We might could play it tomorrow. This is Central Time.